Hey, you guys, today's episode is brought to you by Litbreaker. Litbreaker is an advertising network. It's a way to advertise on multiple websites at once, or you can advertise on one website at a time. It's got versatility, and let me try to explain this even better. Litbreaker is an advertising network for culture vultures, for people who love books, movies, music, art. You can go there, and you can advertise on websites that culture vultures tend to frequent. To learn more, go to litbreaker.com. You can advertise on sites like The Nervous Breakdown, The Rumpus, Large Hearted Boy, The Believer. The list goes on. There's a ton of great sites in the network. And if you want to reach people who go to those sites, look no further. Litbreaker.com. Litbreaker, it's an ad network for people who love books, etc. Go and advertise on it. Oh my God.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Jesus, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it's like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Just one person at just one time.
Right. Okay, right. Everybody, here we go again. This is it. This is other people. This is a regularly scheduled program. This is two people in a room with gray carpeting. How are you? What's going on? I'm Brad Listy. It's nice to be with you. My guest today is Steph Cha. Her latest novel is called Beware, Beware. It is part of the Juniper Song mystery series, and it's out there now from Minotaur Books. I will be talking with Steph momentarily. Before we get started, some mail. I want to share some mail from some listeners. The first one comes from a listener named Brent. He's a regular listener and a regular writer. And here's what he has to say. Dear Brad, just wanted to say how great episode 317 was with Sheila Hedy, Heidi Julewitz, and Leanne Shapton. You said in the monologue that it was logistically difficult having three guests, but I thought it was so cool and completely changed the dynamic of the show. Not that I don't love the dynamic of the show as it usually is. It was a lot of fun to listen to, and the conversation seemed to flow really naturally from topic to topic. And on that note, when you talked about yourself, you were talking about completely different things than you have in the past. And then parenthetically, he says, he's addressing recent criticism of the show that I talk about myself too much, which I keep talking about. So Brent concludes, one of my favorite things about the show is how you let people in. And I think episode 317's guests challenged you in a positive way. Even when you were talking about yourself, it was in the context of their book. And that was really cool. Anyway, Brent. So Sheila Hedy, Heidi Julewitz, and Leanne Shapton, they once again were my guests on episode 317. They edited a book called Women in Clothes. And it's about exactly what it sounds like. It's about women and fashion and clothes and what they mean and so on and so forth. It's very in-depth. And they all sat in this room with me and we talked about it. So, yeah, I was a little nervous about doing the show from a technological perspective. I only have one other microphone here aside from the one that I use. And then, how do I navigate, talking to three people at once? Though that actually went quite well, because they were very good guests. And, it was also a book. I mean, Women in Clothes is a book that lends itself well, I think, to that sort of roundtable discussion. And, what I found interesting about doing that show is the fact that I went into it nervous, feeling like I wouldn't have anything to say. And then I was surprised to learn that I had a lot to say, because, clothing is something we all have thoughts about, whether we realize it or not. And it's one of those things like money where, we use it every day, but we don't give much thought to it because we use it every day, or at least most of us don't give much thought to it. And by thought, I mean like really deep thought about motive, about, choice, etc. So fun show. And perhaps there'll be an opportunity in the future to do another roundtable, but it's got to be the right situation. My neighbor's dog is barking. So the next email that I want to read comes from a listener who calls himself or herself Confused in Santa Cruz. For some reason, I think this is a woman. I have no idea why. Not that men can't be confused in Santa Cruz, but I'm just guessing that this is a woman. So she writes, "Hi, Brad. I'm a longtime listener and fan in Northern California. I took a break from editing student stories this morning to listen to today's episode, and 8 minutes in, I had to turn it off because there was no explanation as to what you were talking about. I've been off the grid regarding any sort of news this week, and the entire monologue, or at least the first 8 minutes, were in code, like listening in on a personal conversation with no shared context. Frustrating. I'll catch up in another way, but as someone who loves your show and considers it a venue for literary news and buzz, I would greatly appreciate monologues on such topics, including at least a short synopsis that would open up your topic to all listeners. I'm guessing that I'm not alone in this. While most of your listeners are avid readers or writers in some fashion, I'm sure, we're not necessarily plugged into the national literary news per se, and consider you a source for that information. Thank you. Confused in Santa Cruz. So, that, you know, this is a good point. And I kind of felt like this after the last episode went live. I worried about it because, you know, for those of you who, haven't heard it, it was episode 318, my conversation with Merritt Tierce. In the monologue, I talked a little bit about last week in literary news. It involved a lot of controversy, a lot of negative stories, a lot of darkness. And, the way that I handled it in the monologue was to kind of speak elliptically. And then I got into this hopefully absurdly funny anecdote about me having an email exchange with Emily Gould, who figures into one of the dark stories from last week. But I didn't get newsy about it. I didn't get into the nitty-gritty. I was trying to sort of lighten the mood, you know, for myself and for everybody else who had been, you know, kind of overwhelmed by, you know, all of the negativity. But, you know, for people who are not aware, for people who are blissfully unaware, there were three really dark stories unfolding in the literary news media last week. The first of which involved Ed Champion, who a lot of people in the literary community know. He's kind of notorious as a blogger, a book blogger, a literary critic, and a podcaster. And I don't know, I truly don't know too much about him, but I've learned via all the media coverage. And I didn't realize how widespread the experience of being harassed by Ed is in the world of publishing. But a lot of people have been on the receiving end of his vitriol. And this summer, it sort of came to a head when, you know, earlier in, summer of 2014 in June, he wrote an 11,000-word screed against Emily Gould, the author, among other females. And it generated a lot of outrage. It was a very, very vicious piece that many people found very offensive. And, you know, they thought it went beyond the pale. It went, you know, it wasn't literary criticism as much as it was personal attack. And, you know, in the aftermath, there was a lot of blowback, and Ed Champion threatened to take his own life. And he did not follow through. And then you fast forward to last week, late September, and Ed Champion went after a young female author named Pora Chista Kakpur. They had been friends, and then and this is where it starts to get absurd, but I guess Pora Chista had deleted one of Ed's Facebook comments on a post she made on her Facebook wall, and he said something that she felt was too nasty. She deleted it. He received that as like an affront. Censorship. I don't know. He felt betrayed by that, I guess, and then wound up lashing out against her on Twitter. And he tried to extort her. He said that he was going to release the name of a man who had taken nude photographs of her if she didn't publicly apologize to him by 11 p.m. You can't make this shit up. So Pora Chista then went public with her dismay, and it created a huge amount of backlash. And once again, when the backlash happened, Ed threatened to take his own life. Apparently, his longtime girlfriend left him. And this time, he went up onto the Manhattan Bridge and stopped traffic and was, you know, about to take his own life. And the police came in and someone pulled him off the bridge. And he was committed to a mental hospital. So that's that story. And it's just really ugly and tragic and sad. And what can you say? I hope that Ed gets well. and I feel for, you know, Emily and Porochista and everyone else who has kind of had to be, you know, bear the brunt of that, the abusive behavior. So that's the first story. The second two stories involve Stephen Tully Dirks and Tao Lin. These stories I'm less inclined to, you know, get into too much because they feel less concrete to me. I mean, the basic facts are that Stephen Tully Dirks was accused of sexual assault by a young woman named Sophia Katz, who wrote an essay on Medium.com talking about a trip she had made to New York City. You know, she's a young woman. She had come down to New York City. Stephen had invited her to stay with him, and then when she stayed with him, he made unwanted sexual advances on her, and it just got ugly. So she wrote this essay. He was outed. I think she called him Stan in the essay. She didn't even name him, but then he was later named on Tumblr or something, and then all, you know, all hell broke loose. He wound up shutting down his longtime alt-lit blog called Pop Serial, or he stepped down from it. And by the way, and not to make light in the middle of a dark story, but I want to say it was Gawker, like, said something to the effect of, like, you know, he retired from public life, which seems to be a bit grandiose for, like, an alt-lit blog. Like, nothing against alt-lit or blogs, but it would sort of be like me saying that I'm going to retire from the world of podcasting. I'm stepping down from public life as the host of a podcast. Like, the two things don't square. But anyhow, so a ton of response to that situation and to that story, like, you know, on social media, in the media, a lot of debate, a lot of ugliness, frankly, a lot of anger. And that story was followed shortly thereafter by E.R. Kennedy, a young man named E.R. Kennedy, formerly a young woman named Ellen Kennedy, coming out with allegations of sexual abuse and emotional abuse by the author Tao Lin. And, you know, Tao dated Ellen when he was 22 and she was 16. And, you know, ER recently, this was like 10 years ago almost, but ER tweeted, I guess, recently that, you know, he had been abusive. Tao wrote a novel called Richard Yates, which seems to detail a lot of this behavior and, in, you know, a lot about this relationship. So, you know, you can't conflate these stories. One is not the other. In the case of the second two, I feel like I know less, and I feel less prepared to speculate because, you know, it's such a heavy charge, you know? And there is a difference between, like, bad sexual behavior or emotionally abusive behavior and rape. They both suck, but one sucks a lot more. One's a crime that carries with it jail time. And that's, you know, that's my, I think, part of my reticence. The other part of it just comes from how much hostility there is and how quick people are to go on the attack. I don't want to set anyone off. So I don't know in this. I don't have anything definitive to say, which I think was part of why I was reluctant to get too far into it. It's that and just not wanting to say something stupid, which, believe it or not, I've been known to do from time to time. It's very sensitive material. So I hope that explains it, you know, and that's what I was referring to in episodes, you know, episode 318's monologue. So thank you for the letters. If you guys want to write to me, the address is letters@otherppl.com, letters@otherppl.com. I love hearing from you, so feel free to write. My guest, once again, is Steph Cha. Her latest novel, Beware, Beware, is out there now from Minotaur Books. Wonderful to have her here on the program, and I hope you guys enjoy this one. Here she is. This is Steph Cha, and her book, once again, is called Beware, Beware.
I think the PI figure is one that's able to go to a whole lot of different places, and it feels organic. Like, he has a reason to travel from A to B and then go to completely different place, interview a completely different kind of person. So I think that has something to do with it. I also think...
Yeah, he's the only person who's, like, actually going to do that much driving, aside from, like, a cab driver.
Yeah, exactly. Which, you know, somebody should write a cab driver noir. I'm sure it's been done.
An Uber...
Actually.
No, it's going to be an L.A. Uber noir.
Yeah.
The black car, it's perfect.
And it'll be a little bit obnoxious, probably.
I do wonder. I do want to read a novel, like where the protagonist is an Uber driver.
Actually, there is a novel that the cab driver Nora that I haven't read yet, but it's AX Ahmad, but I think it's about New York cab drivers. Yeah, I think the famous Mike Davis book, City of Quartz, there's a theory in there that Angelenos understand their history through noir. It's this idea of, like, sunshine and darkness.
Right.
Where, you know, you come to sunny California and there's still all this shit. And so it's kind of fun to play with that, I think, because there's an expectation of brightness.
Yeah, well, no, it's like the perfect weather and the beautiful people and the beaches and, you know, but it's a big city and there's, you know, corrupt police officers and there's really dark crime and, you know, I guess that contrast is sort of irresistible to writers. And the other thing I've heard about Los Angeles, or I've heard said about Los Angeles with respect to fiction and with respect to Los Angeles noir in particular, is that it's an easy city to disappear in.
Yeah.
You know, like you can kind of sort of blend in and people, like, what do people do here? You know, how many times have you had that conversation? You drive past the cafe at noon and like things packed and, you know, people are just in their t-shirts and like, what do people do? Does anybody work? You know?
Yeah, I do. I do wonder about that. And also, I mean, here's an example. There's a bar called El Hermosillo in Highland Park, which is a neighborhood that's gentrifying now, but it's been historically mostly Latino neighborhood, and it's still like mostly Latino. And you go into this bar and it's a really cool beer bar and every single person is white. Maybe there's like one or two Asians. I don't know. I've been like the one Asian, and it's like, I know that this neighborhood is not full of white people. Like, where is everybody else?
Right.
And I think people disappear, maybe sometimes altogether, but a lot of different groups are just invisible to each other. And I think that's kind of interesting. And if you try a little bit, you can see everybody, but, you know, most people are not trying. And that's not necessarily a failing. I think it's just how we work.
It is odd, though, because Los Angeles, I believe, is the most multicultural city per capita, or whatever the numbers break down to. There's more cultures represented in Los Angeles or Los Angeles County than anywhere else in the country. And I was sort of like, you know, feeling happy about Los Angeles the other day when I was thinking about, I don't know, like compared to some cities, it's pretty tolerant place.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up here as a Korean American, was that your experience? Like, do you have like a fairly like good view of Los Angeles in that light, or do you see it differently?
No, I love Los Angeles. And I think I grew up with a lot of Korean Americans. I didn't know many in school until high school, but...
You didn't know many Korean Americans until high school?
Yeah, not in school.
Okay.
But I had a church.
Okay.
And I think...
What was the denomination? Or
It was Methodist. My grandpa's a Methodist minister. He's retired now. But I think the church becomes a hub of the Korean American community. And I went in like middle school, high school when like I wasn't... I had strict parents. I wasn't generally like hanging out with friends outside of school, but I would go to church and I got to hang out with all these people. And most of them were not even there for church. They were just there to see friends. And it became this community hub. Actually, I think the Armenian American community is similar. They all go to church. I just went to an Armenian wedding last weekend, and it was in this massive Armenian cathedral in Burbank. I was like, where did this come from?
Right.
This exists. And there were 300 people at the wedding. Almost all of them were Armenian. The couple met at church. I mean, I think immigrant groups find their enclaves. And, you know, my experience was that my parents both speak fluent English. They immigrated here when they were... My dad was 12 when he came. My mom was 15.
Why did they come over?
There was a big wave of Korean immigration in the 70s, I want to say. And it's just the same immigrant reasons, like opportunity, education.
They weren't like fleeing anything.
No,
really,
no, they weren't. But I think
your father wasn't an outlaw.
No outlaws. And my minister grandpa definitely was not an outlaw.
Oh, right, he's a man of God.
Yeah, but they came. You know, my mom's mom was divorced, which wasn't like a big thing in Korea then, so that might have been part of that. But yeah, so they came and put down roots. And now I really don't have much family in Korea, actually.
Really? Like yeah. Most of your family has come over?
Yeah.
They did. They
at
all...
least cousin. All my cousins are here. And most of them are in the LA area, actually.
You go back to Korea?
Once every couple years, actually, I do. I'll go with my mom. But it's not really going back for me. It's like a place that I've become familiar with just because I really like it.
Yeah.
And I have some distant relatives there, but it's not really a visiting thing. Although I had a couple friends that who were teaching there at various points, so I would see them.
And okay, yeah, and like when you go back, there's nobody to see. Everyone's over here, so it's just kind of you're just traveling essentially.
Yeah.
But do you feel a connection?
I do feel a connection. I mean, when I go over there, it's not like I'm treated like a Korean. You know, my Korean is shitty. It's okay.
You can understand, but it's harder to speak.
Yeah. And I can speak, but I get tongue-tied really easily, and it's just like talking to somebody with a third-grade level
I'm that way in
understanding
English.
Of the language. So, yeah, I don't... It's not entirely like I'm at home or anything, but I really do love it. And, yeah, I think part of it is, like, the food, the atmosphere. It just makes sense to me.
K-pop, and, the culture. It's an interesting culture.
Yeah, I went through a huge K-pop phase when I was in sixth grade, seventh grade.
Yeah.
And so whenever I hear those songs, I just am blasted with nostalgia.
Yeah, I was reading about, I forget what I was reading. I got a book. There's a book sitting over here. I forget what it's called.
Hang on. I know what book you're talking about.
What is it?
Korean Cool? The Birth of Korean Cool?
Yeah. Okay. That came my way. So it's interesting how popular that's become worldwide.
Yeah.
So, growing up, you said you didn't meet other Korean-Americans until you were in junior high at church.
No,
or
I met
school,
them in,
I mean.
In school. Yeah.
But, so, where were you living that you weren't interacting with other Korean-Americans all that much?
Encino.
Okay. So, not a huge Korean-American population?
No.
It's mostly just, what, whiteies? And...
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I think it's a heavily Jewish neighborhood, I want to say.
I don't know. You know what? I've never been to Encino. I've lived here for 13 years.
It's suburbia.
Okay.
There's no real reason to go over there. I mean, I go over there because my parents are still there.
It's nice.
Yeah.
It's
no, nice it's really nice. And I go and I hang out. You know, my husband and I tried to get dinner at a gastropub once at 9 o'clock and the kitchen was closed.
Oh, really?
So.
That's not normal.
You know, it's not a place where you'd hang out if you didn't have a special reason to hang out there.
Okay. But a nice place to grow up. Safe place.
Yeah. Definitely. Okay.
So, in growing up, your parents were strict.
Yeah.
Not letting what you couldn't go play at a friend's house?
I mean, I could, but I remember there was a rule that I could go to sleepovers only if it was a birthday.
Okay.
And, I mean, I didn't have that many friends. I had like 5 friends, maybe, who would invite me to sleepovers on a birthday. And they didn't always have sleepover birthdays. So it's like I slept over at a friend's house like a few times a year.
I'm scared of that as a parent. I have a daughter and I'm like,
oh, yeah.
I got to really know the parent. Plus, like, she's going to sleep somewhere else. Like, I'm not ready for that yet.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. But it was very frustrating. And I had a sense that other parents were not as strict.
Yeah.
Are
you an only child?
No, I have. Actually,
I didn't mean to point at you when I said accusatorily.
Do I give off only child?
No.
I have 2 younger brothers. One is actually 17. And the 17-year-old has a completely different experience from me.
Because he's a boy or because he's the youngest?
Because he's the youngest.
Yeah.
Although, I think partly because he's a boy.
Plus, like, you went to Stanford and Yale?
Yeah.
He's got a lot to live up to. Or maybe your parents are like, at least we, you know, our daughter's a shining star. She's publishing books. She's got an Ivy League education.
Well, I think they still expect excellence from him. But they're not, like, on the assembly line making sure that happens. He is a very driven person. He's kind of a 40-year-old man. I think that's part of being completely neglected in many ways as the third child.
But also, like, this thing about expecting excellence and being a good student, I mean, that is something that's often associated with, like, Asian-American.
Yes.
Like, culturally, in Korean-American culture, like, how much of that is emphasized that's, like... That would be different than, say, like, you know, my parents or something. Like, is it something that's really acute?
It is. I mean, that has been my experience. And, you know, I kind of bristle at the model minority stereotypes. But there is some truth to the fact that, like, education is, like, very valued in the Korean American community. I think part of it is a little bit of the whole competitive thing. Because I think it's because we're a large but still compact community, if that makes sense. Like, there are a lot of us, enough to compete with each other, but small enough that everyone knows if, you know, so-and-so's kid did, you know.
Right.
Like, got drunk and hit someone with a car, or so-and-so's kid is going to Harvard Med. Like, you kind of hear these stories. So I think part of it is that competitiveness, the keeping up with the Joneses, but there are like a million, you know.
Yeah. So
not
okay.
A million, but.
Your parents strict?
I mean, they were.
Like, how, in terms of enforcing this, or is this mostly, do you feel like it was mostly just like innate self?
No, I grew up just with a finger in my back, like all the way until college. And I actually did okay under that regime. Like, I didn't rebel.
It's a regime.
Yeah.
Just the fact that you're characterizing it as a regime. It's interesting.
And it's mostly my mom. My dad expected the results, but my mom was the one who was kind of responsible for getting me to things. And
so tell me what to do, you know, because as you know, you went to Stanford, I mean, it must have worked. You went to Stanford and Yale. So you had to do your homework. Did you have to do extra homework?
Yeah. I mean, I think this worked on me because I do well under pressure, and because I don't put that much pressure on myself. I actually am, at base level, an extremely undisciplined person. So I think this worked well for me because I had outside motivation, basically my mom breathing down my back, breathing down my neck.
The regime was breathing on me, basically.
But yeah, I had, let's see. I went to private school, and that was like a thing that nobody ever questioned. I was just stuck in private school. And
what do you mean nobody ever questioned it?
Just like, I think there was never any idea that I would go to a public school.
Okay.
And I think part of it is where we lived, and part of it is just like my parents wanted to like not take any risks and just put me in private school.
What do your folks do?
My dad runs like a commercial real estate, like, leasing office space.
Right.
And my mom is a housewife.
Okay.
So she was really bearing down.
Yeah.
I mean, that was her job.
You think, if you become a mother, you think you'll do the same thing, or do you think you would take a different approach?
No, I mean, I think I'll have to see what the kid is like and what the kid can handle. Like, her approach was different with both of my brothers. I mean, this one in the middle is just a lot more sensitive than I am.
Are any of the kids screw-ups? Like, there's got to be one out of three.
I mean, the one in the middle, he's not a screw-up, but he, he, you know, he, like, he has dropped out of college and, you know, is still, like, figuring his life out.
Right.
But, no, I wouldn't call him a screw-up.
Well, I know.
But he is not somebody who, like, studied really hard and went to top school, no.
Okay. See, I can empathize with him. It's my tribe right there. So, yeah. Okay. So you, grow up, you're going to these like private schools in Los Angeles. Good experience?
Yeah, I had a great experience. And I actually, the school I went to was a highly gifted school, and it was like,
what was it?
Merman.
Okay. What does that mean? Highly? Like, it means you were a special talent?
It means we were IQ tested in.
Oh, okay.
Which is ridiculous. Like, what does IQ test mean when you
have
like a bunch of...
What was your IQ when, as a child?
I was 155.
Holy shit.
That's good IQ.
That's good. That's like genius level. 140 is genius level.
140 was the cutoff for the school.
Okay.
But...
You beat it handily.
You know, I don't know what that exactly means, right? Because people have different levels of aptitude, and like IQ tests are generally suspect. I do think that the crop of kids was smarter than your average school, but... It was a school for nerds, and it was great. Like, I really liked it. I was the worst athlete at this school, which is,
well, you can't be a genius at everything. You can't be, come on. That would just be unfair if you were also a gifted athlete. Like, when you say, like, you know, high IQ gifted school or whatever, like, were you testing high on math? Like, are you good at language and math and science? Is it the whole package, or are you one of these people who's like extremely strong in languages, but maybe not quite as strong in the math and science department?
I'm good at languages and math. Those were kind of the two things I was best at growing up and all the way through high school.
You do calculus?
Not anymore.
Back in the day.
Back in the day. I did. Okay. Actually, I did math counts. I did various competitions, and I, you know, was on the high track math, and I never really liked it that much. I was good at it.
I found it dry.
I
find, like, talking to writers, there are some. It's like a minority of the people that I've spoken with, but there are some writers who have a really strong mathematical mind, and that mathematical mind serves their writing. Like, yeah. I feel like it informs the way they build their books.
No, I think that makes sense. I mean, it's an understanding of structure and how the world works in a pretty building block way.
Well, we were talking about Ben Laurie, who is a buddy of both of ours here in Los Angeles, and I had him on the show, and I think we were talking about something similar. And he's got an almost mathematical approach to how he plots his stories.
Yeah, like diagrams the story.
Exactly. Like that is something that probably would never occur to me.
No, that's like a little too genius level for me.
Okay, so you leave this, this gifted and talented school. You go to another private school, or you stay there the whole time?
Yeah.
Okay.
And oh, the reason I brought up the private school thing was that you asked if I had like other things going on. I also had supplemental math, like just on this side. I did Kumon. Do you know what that is?
I have no idea.
Okay, if you go around town and you see signs for Kumon.
Okay. How do you spell that?
Kumon.
Okay.
It's a math center where it's extracurricular math. You go and they give you workbooks and you do math and you do like 5 sheets a day. And this was just my nightmare until I was maybe 12, at which point, for some reason, my mom said, okay, you can stop. But I did that like every day, and it was the logo for Kumon is actually a sad kid. It's like the O is like a smiley face, you would think, except it's like two dots and a line.
Yeah. just like a kid who's completely like drained of all.
Yeah. It's like
happiness.
Parents, if you want your child to look like this because she's studying so hard, like come here.
Well, you know, it's an interesting debate. When it comes to parenthood and education and, you know, I'm right in the thick of all that. And like, there's the whole like tiger mom thing and how hard are you supposed to be on your children? And is there a payoff? And you know,
the tiger mom, by the way, was my professor in law school.
No shit. What do you mean? You know, where do you fall on that? I mean, I think there's something to it. You know, you push your kids a little bit and it can be good for them and they can wind up reaping rewards.
Can just completely collapse.
Right. You push them too hard and they're like, they're going to resent you. And I guess you just have to read the individual child and hope that you have a good sense.
Yeah, I think that's where I fall. I mean, I don't resent my childhood. There are certain things I would have been like, mom, you can relax. I'm going to turn out okay. But like...
You're like, I got this. I got the Kumon, mom.
Yeah, I can like sleep over at my friend's house. She was really nervous that we would like... She's like, girls get into stupid things. Like, you might call boys. And I was like, mom, no, we were just like...
They didn't want you to date.
Oh, no. No, they didn't until pretty late. But not that that was really... I didn't have like boys knocking on my door all the time trying to get my number. No.
Come on. You're attractive. You didn't have that in high school? Maybe.
No, not at all.
Well, they're probably scared of your mom.
No, when I was in high school, I like, you know, I wore sweatpants to school. I had like a blanket because I slept in my car in the morning for
really?
Like half an hour. Yeah, I would get to the school really early so that I could I could park in my spot without other cars being there because I was a terrible, terrible driver, which is like another one of those stereotypes that I'm constantly confirming. And I hate it. I hate it. But when I was 16, I was like the worst driver anyone's ever seen.
Yeah. Where does that even come from that Asians are bad
drivers? I
don't know.
I actually have a theory about this, that we have that, you know, Korean society is like fairly patriarchal. And so driving is a skill that kind of codes male. And, you know, my dad taught my brothers to drive, like, very hands-on. He never did that with me.
Yeah. I always drive whenever my wife and I go somewhere. But I like to drive when I go somewhere with anyone. I could be in the car with, like, the winner of the Indy 500 and I would want to drive. Because I like to be at the... I feel like if I'm at the wheel, I know that there's going to be a good driver.
Yeah. No, I don't... Yeah, I don't mind driving. But when I was... So when I was in high school, I would get there really early because... The spots were really narrow, and so I was really worried about hitting the people next to me. But then I'd had to drop off my brother at the bus stop early anyway, so I just went straight. But that meant I had half an hour before school started, And so I would nap in my car and I had a blanket. But then it would be 7 o'clock. No, not seven. When does school start? When does high school start? Like eight?
8 o'clock, 7:30, something.
I don't know.
Like that.
Something crazy.
Too early.
Yeah, way too early. And I would get out of my car and it would feel too cold to transition from napping. So I would take my blanket in and look like a homeless person. So yeah, that's like what I was like at
I was not dating. That's unusual. Because like I feel like a lot of teenage adolescent girls, like, you know, I remember my older sister when we were growing up. Like, up early at the crack of dawn to, like, blow dry her hair and put on all this makeup and do all that. You weren't doing that.
No. I mean...
I think that kind of shows, in a way, it shows some confidence. Like, you didn't give a shit. You weren't going to play those games. No?
Yeah, I don't think it was that. I mean, it's not like I wasn't a confident teenager. I always felt like I was kind of a loser.
Everybody who's a teenager feels like they're a loser.
Is that true?
But then there's the teenagers who have this bravado. But show me a 16-year-old who thinks, like, I got it. I mean, maybe outwardly, but inwardly, I think when we're teenagers, we all feel like,
okay,
you know. I mean, right?
Yeah.
That's the teen experience. But, you know, the fact that you're wearing sweatpants, you're walking in, like, caped, essentially.
Yeah, I actually had somebody come up to me when we were all finding out about colleges. Somebody I'd never met before asked, "Where are you going to school?" And I said I was going to Stanford. She's like, "Oh, thank God you're not going to the East Coast."
Why?
Because I'm like wearing a blanket in California.
Yeah, we'll see. In California, though, you can dress down a little bit more. I think if you're on the East Coast, people expect maybe a higher level of fashion or something.
I think just the weather.
Oh, that too.
Yeah. I hated the East Coast, by the way.
You did.
You're not
a West Coast girl.
Yeah.
Okay.
What
did, you, what did you know? Because you went to Yale afterwards?
Yeah. I went for law school. So I lived there for 3 years.
And you hated it?
I just hated it.
Why?
It was miserable. I hated the weather. There was one winter, my second year, where I got pretty depressed for a couple months because, I mean, some, like, family shit had happened, but, like...
What happened?
It was... My uncle, who was my favorite uncle, we were really close, like... turned out to have been like this dickhead who'd been cheating on his wife for years. And
ugh.
So, I mean, it was just one of those things where like that really upset me, but I'd already been upset because winter had been going on for 5 months.
Yeah.
And then it went on for like another 2 months. Uh-huh. And I was just like, this is bullshit. Like, I can't believe this. And I have to live here another year. Like, I just want to like never leave my house again.
Yeah. The winter, you know, it can do that. I mean, I grew up in it, but, is that the only time you've ever had a depressive episode, or do you feel like?
Yeah, I'm not generally a depressed person, and that was very situational.
Yeah,
I mean, I have
or seasonal.
Yeah, exactly. I have, you know, friends and relatives who struggle with depression, and I can't pretend to understand that. That's like a completely different thing. But I mean, yeah, I've been sad.
Sure.
I've definitely been sad.
But never like, I can't get out of bed.
No. Right? Never like, the fun things aren't fun sad.
Yeah. Never like, I can't eat. Or,
yeah, no.
Yeah.
No.
That's like a different level.
Yeah. It's not like the chemicals in my brain are doing things and like just fucking with me for the fun of it.
Right.
It's more like something happened or everything is gray.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a good reason to be depressed.
Yeah.
So, but you like Stanford?
I love Stanford, yeah.
Stanford seems like what a great place to go to school.
It was pretty good, yeah.
And you studied there. Were you thinking of being a writer at that age, or was it something that was in the back of your mind and kind of shelved? Or
back of my mind, I would say. I took a class on American detective fiction my freshman year, and that's when I read, like, the big noir people. I read Chandler, Hammett, mostly. And even then, I thought it would be cool if there were a Korean-American version of a Chandler novel, because I'm from LA.
Okay.
And so it had been in my mind that should exist. And
but like, why beyond? Like, you're from LA. Obviously, there's a big Korean-American presence here. There's Korea. For people who don't know Los Angeles, there's an entire section of the city called Koreatown.
Yeah, which is massive.
Massive. And so, but are there other reasons beyond just those basic facts that you thought like there should be a Korean-American noir heroine? You know what I'm saying? Like,
I thought that Chandler would be fun to play with because he's such a white dude. Like, he is so white and so dude-y. Like,
well, and the city used to be less multicultural.
Yeah. Although, I mean, there were you know, he'd have like a Mexican in the book and he'd call him the Mexican or,
yeah.
you know, I think there was in one book, there was a Native American man smoking pot in a car, like nobody with names. And,
yeah.
So I thought it would be fun to write a new LA noir that had more of the diversity in present day LA. And I hadn't really seen anything about the Koreatown experience or the Korean American experience in LA, which is a very specific thing that is still recognizable to a lot of people. So yeah, I had this idea that, someone should write that. And I had wanted to be a writer when I was a kid, but that was kind of my version of wanting to be an astronaut or a ballerina.
Right.
It was not something that I thought people could actually do.
I hear that a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and now I know other writers, and now I realize, like, oh, you don't have to be a superhuman. You can just write a book. You can just sit down. You can discipline yourself and, like, write 80,000 words. But I think it's very daunting to see if all you see of writers is just the hardcovers in a store. Like, that doesn't seem like a person actually did that. Or if it is a person, it's, like, a very gifted person.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think if you fall in love with books or certain books, it's easy to kind of, in your mind, mythologize the person who wrote these things and to create, you know, who created this. They must be some sort of magician.
Exactly. And I didn't know anybody who was a fiction writer, really. I mean, because I didn't major in creative writing. I did English, but I did the literature emphasis. So I took one fiction writing class, I think my sophomore year, and that was it. And then I didn't write again until law school.
Once you were like, oh God, I'm going to be a lawyer.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, I heard that before too. In fact, we were talking about David Connerly now. He's still an attorney, but I mean, you know.
Well, he likes it, though.
He does, he does. But I think I've talked to other people who did law school, and that was sort of the impetus to like get down to business with regard to like the creative writing. So, you have this English degree as a Stanford undergrad, and then you go to Yale Law School. All the way along, you're thinking, I'm going to be a lawyer.
Yeah, I guess.
I want this education as a backup just in case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I wasn't thinking, I'm going to go to law school and then be a writer. That's definitely not what I was thinking. I was kind of, you know, I think what happens to a lot of people, especially the people who go straight through from college to law school, is that you are a humanities major and there are no jobs. Or you have to look really hard to find a job, but you could take the LSAT and see how you do. And if you do well enough, you can go to like a top law school or a decent law school. And at the end of that, you will probably have a job. You know, it might not be your favorite job, but it's secure. So I think a lot of risk-averse people who have humanities backgrounds end up in law school just for that reason. And it's not like I showed up the first day of law school and was like, I am 100% going to be a lawyer. I'm going to do this big. I didn't have like any real conception of what my future would look like. I was just doing the next thing, you know, on this path. And that's like, you know, when I grew up first, you know, 17 years of my life with just my mom telling me what to do.
Right.
And I would just like study and I'd like do well and I'd do the next thing and I'd do the next thing. And I went to college and then the next thing was law school. And after that, I was just like, I'll figure it out.
Yeah. Did you ever have like a dark night of the soul where you're like, I hate the law. I don't want to be a lawyer. What am I doing? Or was it always just like, you know what? I'll get through this. I'll get the degree. It's a good thing to have in my back pocket. And then once I'm done and my mom's happy, I'm going to go start working on fiction or find something that I actually really am passionate about.
Yeah, it was like definitely gradual. I was a summer associate at a big law firm my 1L summer.
New York?
L.A.
Oh, out in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's just a terrible place. Like, I just hated it. And they didn't make us do anything. Like, they didn't make us do any work. They just took us out to, like, nice dinners and, you know, like, we went on a wine tasting thing. They took us on a hike in Switzerland.
Are you shitting me?
This was 2008.
Are they courting
before.
You?
Before.
Is this like a... Is this
yeah.
Like...
Oh, yeah. That's totally... The summer associate program at big law firms is a courtship. It has changed since 2008. So I did a summer in 2009 in New York, and it's completely different. People are stressed out. But yeah, we didn't have to do like...
They took you on a hike like in...
In Switzerland, yeah.
Up in the Adirondacks instead of Switzerland.
Yeah.
After the crash, it was like, we're going to take you on a hike in Central Park.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. But... you know, it was a terrible place.
Well, and like, part of it was. I got to stop you. When it comes to, you know, you're a Yale Law School student, so obviously you're going to be sought after as like a, you know, a young lawyer. I'm imagining firms are looking for Yale Law graduates.
Yeah.
So is it one of those things where they were kind of courting you guys and making it like, we want you to be here just so they could like sign you up and then you would have like the punishing, yes, like junior law?
That's exactly. That's wow. exactly the system. But everyone knows that going in. And part of it was that I saw all these associates who were just overworked like crazy. But that wasn't even what totally turned me off. It was like a litigation firm and it was really fratty. And like, I think like the sexual harassment was just crazy.
Did you experience it?
Yeah.
What happened?
A few different things. In my first weekend there, we went on a firm, like we did the wine tasting, and at the end of the day, there was a party at an associate's house. It's like third year associate. You know, I'm like 22 years old at this point. This third year associate like tried to make out with me at this party. And I was like, no, this is too weird.
Yeah.
But like, you know, that's like a mild thing. On the hike, one of the hiring partner, took us all to Hooters.
What?
Yeah. He took us all
in
to Hooters. Yeah.
There's a Hooters in Switzerland?
There's a Hooters in Switzerland. Oh, it's actually the only Hooters I've ever been to.
I can't believe they've exported that to Switzerland.
Yeah, so he took us to the Hooters, like bought us a bunch of tequila shots. You know, this is like a 60-year-old dude. And it was like fun, whatever. There was a lot of fun between partners and associates. You know, it wasn't like a strictly professional environment, which like has its benefits. It's fun, I guess. But then like the downside is like people aren't professional and they will like sometimes grope you. Right.
Oh,
so, this partner takes us to a discotheque afterwards. And, you know, I didn't even get the worst of it. There was another girl who he was following around. He had his arms around her. She like lost him for a bit and he was going around asking like, where's this girl? Like, where'd she go?
Was he tanked?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, not that that's an excuse, but
maybe. But I'm just trying to like paint a picture.
Probably. I don't know. Or I think he did like the whole like avuncular thing, but it was gross.
Yeah.
And you know, I was sitting at the bar talking to a friend and he came up to, he was doing the rounds, kind of talking to everyone. And the whole time he's talking to me, he has his hand like on my thigh. And I'm wearing a skirt, so it's like just on my skin. And I'm like, what? And like
that. By the way, like it was a huge red flag at Hooters.
Yeah, I know, right? But we get back to the States, and nobody says anything about this happening, and nobody can really complain because he's a hiring partner.
Yeah,
and it's like, and I was just like, I'm not gonna work here. No. This is ridiculous. Well, this is like, insane.
What is it about? And then obviously, you know, I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush because I know there are many companies and business environments that are run by, you know, men for the most part that are not this unhealthy. But what is it about? Like you hear about this kind of fratty boy misbehaving and just like cheesy, you know, it's not even like, I mean, Hooters, like this guy's an attorney, like
I know.
Have some class, you know? If you're going to act like a jackass, like take some people somewhere decent. You're in Switzerland and you go to Hooters. Like, you know what I'm saying? But like, what is it about men? Why are men constantly doing this, especially when you get a bunch of men together and there's a lot of money, you know, like you're at Goldman Sachs and you read these stories about the way things are. And, you know, obviously it's not necessarily everybody who's there, but there's enough people in the banking business that are doing this that you're like,
yeah,
this is just, like shockingly gross.
Yeah. No, there was a story, that went kind of viral yesterday or a couple days ago about this hedge fund manager who groped a bartender. And she wrote an open letter. She found his name on his credit card statement, like wrote an open letter to him, posted a picture.
Good.
And yeah, it was amazing.
Right.
It's so satisfying. And then when he found out about it, his response was, he leads with, I've groped plenty of asses, but I never groped hers. And it's like, that's your opener? Like, that's... No.
Oh my God.
Like at that point, do I believe that she made it up? No, that's crazy.
So, well, and like another thing that comes to mind, particularly in light of the fact that you were at Yale, is that I was just reading not too long ago that an unbelievable percentage of, I think they were talking about Harvard, but it could probably be any of these Ivy Leagues, is that Like a really shockingly large percentage of students go straight from Harvard into the investment banking world.
Yes.
It's like 60%.
Yeah,
it's like this pipeline of people going into that culture.
And consulting is the other one. Yeah. It's called the brain drain, actually, because this is a thing. And I think it's like the same reason I applied to law school, too, though. It's that you are at this elite school and you don't know what to do next, but there are like these recruiters on campus and, oh, they're going to pay you a lot of money if you do this thing. And it's like, oh, you can just like sign up and do this thing. So why not? Like, what else are you going to do? You're going to like find your own job? No. So that, I think that's what ended up happening. I think there is some judgment attached to it. My husband went to Yale undergrad and he said that like, it was kind of touchy when people like went into consulting, like people would be embarrassed about it.
What does that mean? You go into consulting, you're just consulting somebody.
Yeah. You work for one of these big firms and you spend most of your week traveling, talking to, I don't know, whoever needs to.
They need help.
Consult you.
A business needs help and they need your brain to figure out a problem.
And I think a lot of people do this too, because like, this is one of the things that if I looked for it, like I could have done as an English major. So I think it's, I think
you didn't go that route. You're not part of the brain drain.
No.
So when did you, so you get out of law school and then what? How do you get to where you're writing books?
So I started writing my first book in law school. It was actually the summer when I was working at that terrible place, because I was like,
I started writing it in Hooters, actually. I pulled out my notebook.
On my napkin.
Yeah, on my Hooters napkin. Began my literary career.
It was shortly after that, I think, or maybe shortly before. But I started writing because I figured, well, if I'm not going to do law, like I might as well pursue the thing that I thought I might pursue. And so I just started writing. And at first it was kind of for fun. And then it got longer and then it got longer. And, you know, once you write a whole book, I mean, I'm sure you've had this experience. It's like, well, I got to do something with it. I can't just like throw it away. Or if I'm going to throw it away, I should like do that for a good reason. So I wrote the first draft between my second and third years of law school and the second half of my second semester of my third year, I started looking for agents.
Okay.
I mean, at first I had this like fantasy that I would start shopping for agents and I'd have a book deal by the time I graduated. And obviously that did not happen, but I did meet my agent. I was still in New Haven when I met my agent in New York.
How did you meet your agent?
I queried him. I did the cold queries. I did the whole slush pile thing. And he was interested in my book, but not so much that he wanted to sign me. He wanted to see some major edits first. So that took a long time.
Good notes?
Very good notes.
Okay.
Like, he is an excellent editor. And actually, I had a few agents who asked for manuscripts who rejected it for the same reasons that he gave me edits.
Hmm. What were they? Do you remember? I mean, is there anything you can talk
about
that people
I mean,
could grasp not having read the initial?
Yeah, I can just say that I had originally envisioned this project as more of a direct Chandler riff. You know, I like the idea of Marlowe as this man without a past. And it turns out that just does not work with an amateur detective. And I was like, oh, right. But I needed people to tell me that. And so I layered in this whole backstory and it became a much richer novel because of it. And actually, when I had finished my edits for my agent and he still like wasn't responding because he had actual clients who he was
who were making him
who
money.
He was beholden to.
Yeah.
So when I had a draft that I thought was much stronger, I queried again and I got more bites. And that's when I went back to my current agent. And
what's
said,
his name?
Ethan Bassoff.
Where's he at?
He's at LMQ, Lippincott, Massey, McCulkin.
Okay. And like you just cold, like did you look, did he represent writers that you were admiring or something? Is that how you did it? Or
no. I mean, he was at Inkwell at the time, which is just a big agency. And I don't even think I queried him. I queried someone else at the agency.
And it got to him.
And it got to him.
Okay.
And I mean, I queried like at least 60 places. So I did at the time like have a spreadsheet and I kind of looked at, well, who would be a good fit for me? But I don't remember in retrospect, like what exactly made me think that each place would work.
I'm just impressed that you had a spreadsheet.
it's like, yeah, it's like one of the only spreadsheets I've ever made. Like that, and I made a spreadsheet for my wedding.
You do. Okay. Who's going to make
just
the
like
cut?
Too many, it's just like too many pieces. Yeah. It's actually hard to keep track of.
If you're doing that many queries, because there's some, you know, I queried a lot of people when I was out looking for an agent, and you read some things and it's like you shouldn't query too many at once. Obviously, you shouldn't query more than one agent at the same agency because they can both.
Yeah, you
don't want to turn them against one another in terms of trying to pursue you or whatever. But
When they're fighting for my
Well, you know. Or I think it's just bad form.
Yeah, no, it is bad form.
It's just bad form. So it would be nice to be fought over. But, you know, it does get hard to keep track of it all.
Yeah.
It's not a bad approach.
Yeah.
And did you hear back and who asked for what? And it can be easy
to
lose
track. And I could be like, yeah, here's when I queried them. Here's when I heard back. Here's the no, here's the no, here's the no, here's the no, here's the like, send me something else.
Well, and the thing too, I want to talk about is getting notes, because this is a part of it that, it can be confusing for writers or annoying or both. And I think that my experience has been when somebody gives a good note, it's so self-evident.
Yeah.
And the justification for the note is either contained within the note itself, or it becomes obvious the minute they say it, or the person who's giving the note can articulate it to you. And sometimes people get notes or give notes, and the notes are bad. It might just be their opinion. And, oh, I think that you should change this, or I didn't like this. And that's not a note.
Yeah, you know? I got bad notes from another agent who was interested in representing me, he represented a lot more directly commercial fiction, so he was like, well, why don't we make the ending happier, and why don't we make this person not so bad, and why don't we make this person more of a love interest? And I was like, do you like my book?
Right. Well, but I've been through that. It's like, did you even read the thing? And then B, Why don't we make the investigator an old white man? You know, it's like, well, wait a minute. What are you trying to write here? And that's a good question. You know, I think maybe if you put them on sodium pentothal, they would say no. So what's your compelling reason for wanting to represent this? Well, that's good, though. It sounds like you found a good agent. And then once you made those changes, what about the sales process?
So we worked together. So we finally signed. On my 25th birthday.
Huh?
It was a great 25th birthday.
Yeah, that's great.
And we spent another 3 months or so, or maybe 4 months, editing just between me and my agent. He wanted it to be in tip-top shape by the time we sent out. He said the way he operates is that he'll have a short list of editors he's interested in, but he won't approach them until the book is, in his eyes, flawless. Or close to it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said because of that, he really rarely has a book that doesn't sell to somebody. And so we worked on this book and had it finished. And he said, we should hear something in a couple weeks. And I was like, okay, that's a lie, but thank you.
Thank you for sweetly lying to me.
Yeah, I was like, that's... Okay, I'll just count that as optimistic. And we heard back in 2 weeks from an editor at Minotaur. And I talked to her about the book. And she had a couple notes, too. It was much less extensive than anything I'd done before. It was a really easy edit. And the idea was that she really liked the book and she wanted to push it in-house. She needed me to address a few things so that she could have... my suggestions combined with the book, and that could be the package to go to the other people in the house. So I basically wrote a memo on what I would change based on our conversation. And she was like, okay, that works. I'll just use this. And so she went and got the book through pretty quickly. And then she came back and was like, okay, let's make this official. And then, you see that memo you wrote, just do that. So it was all pretty painless once I got there.
Was it a multi-book deal or was it just one?
It was just one.
With an option on the second?
Yeah, it was right of first
refusal.
I think it was first look or whatever on the second. And so, yeah, each of my books, I'm on contract for my third one, but each one has been individual.
But you're writing a series with the same protagonist.
Yeah.
So with Juniper Song.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's very, of the genre or of the noir. You know, to have your private investigator recur across many books.
Yeah.
You getting tired of her?
It's challenging. I'm not tired of her. I think she's a good character. But I don't want to run into the Murder, She Wrote problem where it's like...
What's that?
Where it's like, why is this woman just like, why does she have corpses trailing her? like no one should let her stay at their hotel because like right. someone's going to die.
She should be quarantined.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, so it's, I don't want to run into the problem where like, realistically, if this person existed, she'd be like a Gawker celebrity or something, you know? People would be like, why is this like 20-something private eye like running into every murder in the city? Like that right. is interesting. And the other thing is that there are all these side characters with their own stories, and I'm starting to get to the point where I feel a little bit bogged down by that, because I feel like I have to deal with them, and if I don't, then I'm going to feel like, ugh. And I also feel like the emotional weight of prior novels should carry into the ones I'm working on. And at some point, I think I'm going to have to stop beating up on her.
Like, could it be just a trilogy?
Yeah, I mean, it could be. I don't have an idea for a fourth yet, so we'll see what happens.
And what about a book like this? Because these books, I mean, and I don't mean to oversimplify, but I think with, you know, noir, detective fiction, genre fiction, like the old thought is that these are more plot heavy.
Yeah.
And so do you have to do outlining, like when you're building up a storyline for this character, and do you sit there and meticulously plot it out, or is it something you do more intuitively?
I do it more intuitively. I do it kind of on the go. The first book, I really did it that way because I had an idea for a beginning and an end, and the end was an emotional end. It wasn't a plot end. And I needed to get her there. So I had a few signposts along the way, but I wanted, since it was an amateur detective story, I wanted her to kind of stumble along and like have to solve problems as like I would solve the problem or any civilian would. It had to be recognizable. Now that she's a private detective, it's like, okay, she can be a little smarter and more have access to more tools than that. But so the first one, I wrote the full manuscript before shopping it. The second one, I wrote 100 pages. And the third one, I wrote a pitch. And so the less that I've sold it on, the more I've had to outline because I needed to be like, well, this is what's going to happen next.
Right.
So now I have like a skeleton of the novel, but I'm really doing it just scene by scene. And I actually don't read for plot as much. I mean, plot is important to me, but like that's not primary. So I try to write good plots, but that's not the main thing I'm trying to do. I try to like suss out themes and blah, 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 have good characters. But yeah, it's like I have things that I want to explore, and I'll try to bend the plot to them if possible, if that feels organic.
Do you have like a really strong sense of Los Angeles crime? Like, do you have a police scanner? Do you comb the newspaper every day looking for like murder stories to... Do you know what I'm saying? Like, do you pay attention?
No, I don't do that. Although I'm trying to get in touch with the police officer, because at some point you have to just talk to a police officer. That's just something you need to do.
Yeah.
I think...
they'll have stories.
I think my dad knows a retired police officer, so I'm going to talk to him. But yeah, I haven't gone deep into the disgusting news archives of all the things that happened in L.A. Although somebody posted on my wall the other day that it's timeline now, whatever... Facebook.
Right.
There was a woman who found her neighbor's like decomposing body in the trunk of her car.
Ugh. And wait, in her trunk or in the neighbor's
trunk?
In
her trunk.
Okay.
And my first book, kind of the whole story starts to go crazy when she finds a body in the trunk of her car. So someone posted that on my wall. So.
Isn't it nice when people start posting murder
it's
stories?
Like, hey, this murder reminded me of you.
Right. This decomposing body immediately brought you to mind. Wow. Okay. So your folks, are they pleased with you and your career choice? They must be proud of you since you're publishing these books. And
they are. And I think, I don't know. I don't even think they fully believed that I would ever be a lawyer. I think they thought it was possible. Although I am a lawyer. I will say I'm a licensed attorney. I do that as my day job.
Yeah.
I do that. We can talk about that later, but I do like only half the year. So they, you know, I think they're really proud of it. They're happy with the books and they are supportive and like tell their friends. And oh my God, the most embarrassing thing is my dad ordered a license plate frame that says in Comic Sans, I read Stepchild's Follow Her Home, and I was like, no, you can't. Oh my God. This
in
is
Comic
like,
Sans.
This is like so sweet, but it's so embarrassing. How do I tell you like to just hide that forever?
Oh my, no, I like it. You got to just let it go. You got to let it go. It's so great. I love your dad. Did you ever, I mean, all this achievement, you know, like from childhood onward, did you ever have like a crazy period? Did you ever go nuts a little bit or no?
No, I never did.
It's yet to come. Something to look forward
to.
Yeah,
maybe I'll snap. No, I mean, I think I'm a very level-headed, boring person. I think the most interesting thing about me by far is that I write novels. And, you know, you meet writers who have, like, so many other things going on and just, like, so interesting and complicated.
I think you're interesting.
You know, it's like, I feel like my whole life has been, like, I studied, I went to school, and then I wrote this book. And, like, here I am. I got a basset hound. That's, like, the most interesting thing about
it. What is your basset hound's name?
His name is Duke.
Duke, okay.
He's wonderful.
Why a basset hound?
My husband really wanted a basset hound since he was a kid.
Okay.
Just the ears and the droopiness. And I was not even a dog person until we got the dog. And now I'm just, like, full-on basset lady.
There you go. Yeah, are you gonna have kids? Do you know?
Yeah, I think so. In like a few years.
That basset hound will take a back seat quickly.
That's what I've heard.
It's crazy. My dog Walter used to be like the center of our world. And then we had a child and we're like, did you feed him?
How old is your kid?
4.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, some people maybe it's to greater and lesser extents, but you have a child and all of a sudden that takes up so much of your time. A lot of the energy that you use to focus on your dog then appropriately shifts to your child.
Yeah, no, I've heard, I forget who told me this, but he said, like, I was talking about, we'd heard of a dog that came into our rescue organization because they had a baby and the baby just started breaking out in hives.
Oh.
It's like very allergic to the dog. And I was just joking around with friends and I was just like, you know, like, Duke was here first. Like, we could, like, give the baby away and that would just be fair. And my friend who had a kid was just like, you will be so shocked at how fast your loyalties change.
Yes, they do. They do, you know. And I guess that's appropriate. It makes sense.
Yeah.
You can't, I mean, there's just not enough energy to go around. So Duke should enjoy it while it lasts.
And, you know, it's true. And, like, the dog, if you want to be away from the dog, you can, like, put it in a cage and leave.
Yes.
Can't do that with the child.
You can't? Oh, shit. So what about the future? Like, have you planned your future? Or is it one day at a time for you? Do you have, like, a sense of where you want to be artistically? And, you know, do you want to be writing detective novels and having them turned into movies and have, like, an Elmore Leonard career? Do you want to shift to literary fiction at some point?
I have goals. I don't know how many of them are realistic. My main goal is that at some point in my life, I can, like, quit my day job and still not just be a housewife with a hobby, you know? I it's important to me that I contribute to our household finances and, like, you know, could be self-sufficient.
Sure.
I'd like to, in, like, 10 to 15 years, be able to do some combination of writing novels and writing essays or reviews. I do book reviews and I do food reviews too. So
I don't review food, like, yeah. restaurant.
Yeah, or? I do restaurant roundups and reports for the LA Times food section.
What's good? Where should I be eating?
Oh my God. Like, that could be like a whole other show.
Right.
I mean, in LA, Korean food, Thai food and Mexican food are the ones that are the genres that I recommend to people from out of town. But there's just so much good stuff. It's a great food scene. I like the food scene in LA better than the food scene in New York or SF because, like, who cares if you have, like, a 3-star Michelin restaurant? Like, are you going to eat there every day? No.
Right.
Like, you're going to eat there never. You only eat once every time you get married, you know, something like that.
Right.
So, yeah, I love
Los Angeles has great food.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a lot of restaurants, the food truck thing originated here.
Yeah.
You know, we have some good experimental stuff happening. And I found too, like, I'll be traveling someplace and my wife and I'll say, like, oh, I miss the food in Los Angeles.
Oh yeah.
You know?
No, there's so much stuff. Yeah. Oh, it's so great. I Yelp. That's actually how I got both the book reviewing and the food reviewing gigs.
You're a Yelper.
Yeah.
You actually, like, when you go someplace, you immediately go home and Yelp it?
No, I have, like, a 2-month backlog.
Oh, you do?
Because I Yelp every place I go to. I would Yelp your house if it had a Yelp account.
Don't Yelp me, please. Don't
No, I mean,
that.
It's, like, it's pathological at this point. I have Yelped every place I've been to since 2008.
Why?
Because I'm a crazy person. I don't know. It started because it was really fun to... And I like writing. I think it makes sense because I like writing and I like food. And it's really easy for me to write about a restaurant. It's the easiest thing in the world. It just comes out. So it's actually a good writing exercise. I do it every day.
I'm glad, but you know what? I'm like, I say like with some mystery, like why do you Yelp? How can you? But I'm glad that you do.
I have over 2,000 reviews.
Holy. And so that's what you pointed to when you got the food reviewing gig?
No, what happened was that I met Jonathan Gold when he was judging a Korean barbecue competition, and I just went up to him afterwards. I had this like restaurant that I'd been to that a lot of people didn't know about.
And Jonathan Gold is like he won the Pulitzer Prize for food.
And he's the LA Times restaurant critic, one of them. The other one, is S. Irene. But he ended up going to this restaurant I recommended. And then I think he found my Yelp account. And so he's told me anyway, and apparently has told other people that I'm the best person on Yelp, which is good endorsement. I should get that on.
I'm going to go check. How do I check out your Yelp? I did.
You just like go to any restaurant in LA with any kind of profile and look for the person with a koala hat. Steph C.
You have a koala hat?
Yeah. In my picture, I have a koala hat.
Like a baseball hat?
It's like a beanie, but it's like the shape of the top of a koala's head.
Okay.
And I'm eating an ice cream cone.
All right.
But yeah, so Jonathan Gold tapped me to be a restaurant scout. He has like this team. Everyone else is like a food blogger of like decent stature, and I'm like the plebe Yelper.
Well, that's the way you got to start somewhere. Pretty soon you'll be winning the Pulitzer Prize.
Yes.
So you got to give a recommendation. What's your favorite restaurant? Where do you go? Like, give me like a restaurant that's a go-to restaurant for you.
Okay, Soban. S-O-B-A-N. That's okay. My favorite Korean restaurant.
Where is that?
It's on Olympic, and that's the one I told Jonathan Gold about.
Okay. And did he like it? He must have liked it.
Yeah. It's on like the 101 Essential LA restaurants and everything now.
Oh,
it's on Olympic and Wilton. This is like LA talk, but
yeah. Well, no,
it's really good. They're known for their raw marinated crab, which is like, it's not a food that you see too many places. I don't think too many cultures do raw crab, but it's delicious. It's like very gelatinous. You like bite onto the shell and you suck out all the meat, and there's like the goopy crab roe, and it's divine.
Soban.
Yeah.
Okay. What, and that's just Korean barbecue, or is it Korean?
No, it's like home-style Korean food.
Home-style Korean food.
Although fancier than you would do at home.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, do you have ambitions, though? Obviously you like to write about food, but is that part of your... I mean, I get that would be an interesting career. You're like writing noir fiction. Do you want to write literary fiction at any point?
Actually, yeah, so food writing was never part of the plan. It was a hobby.
Okay.
It was just something I was doing for fun. I think I'm decent at it, but it's not. It was never my ambition to be a food critic.
What makes someone a good food writer? The ability to describe the food,
and make it sound delicious.
Yeah,
and I think I don't know, paying attention to things. I actually don't have a very developed palate. It's not. I don't have like a very sensitive palate, I should say. So maybe I'm not the best person for that kind of thing. But I can write about food and make you want to eat it.
Did you Yelp the Hooters in Switzerland?
I did not, because it was in Switzerland.
Oh, okay.
Anywhere, it's actually a relief for me when I travel places that don't have Yelp, because I'm like, oh, I can just eat. I don't have to... Like, Yelping is part fun and part chore, because now I feel like I'm just tied to it, because I've been doing it for so long. I can't just, like, throw it in the toilet.
Yeah.
I have, you know, it's like hundreds of thousands of words that I've written. I think, like, I counted 2 years ago, and it was 400,000 words. So it's like... by far my largest body of work. But yeah, it's just for fun. And in the future, I would like to, you know, if something happens, I'm not going to say no, but I think so many people really want to do it that I feel like that's probably not in the cards for me.
It's like travel writing. Everybody I want to be one of those people who gets to go on vacation and write about it. It's like people want to go out and eat for free and write about it.
Exactly. I don't think I'm going to be the person who like is not striving and just like gets handed like a food critic job at somewhere that pays well, you know? So it's like, I'd rather devote my energy to my fiction writing. And, I do want to transition into literary fiction at some point.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. I actually, I have those ambitions, and I think it's because I read mostly literary fiction. I read some mystery. And the mystery I read tends to have some kind of literary bent because, you know, sentences matter to me as a reader and as a writer. And I don't know. I don't feel like I have to be tied to having a murder in every book. I think it's not that easy to transition, so we'll see what happens. But
You mean like transition and still have a readership? I mean, you're
reading. Yeah,
you're
or like even sell a book to a publishing house. But I think.
Maybe
I
it could
know.
Be like a literary novel with a crime in it and like a food truck. There,
yes.
It would be perfect. A yelping.
That sounds very LA, actually. Right. Yeah, there are literary writers who dip into crime fiction, and everyone loves that. But I think it's harder to go the other way. Michael Chabon and Kazuo Ishiguro have done crime novels. Actually, Jonathan Lethem started as doing crime, and then now he's like Fortress of Solitude. And,
right.
Yeah.
He can kind of do it all.
Yeah, but you know there aren't that many Jonathan Lethems.
Well, maybe you could be the next.
We'll see. That would be cool.
Yeah.
But I want to write about Korean Americans in LA, and there are many ways to do that.
And you think that's going to be your milieu? Like you're going to stick with that?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think every character is ever going to be... I don't think I'm ever going to have a book where everyone's Korean, but I think there are few enough people doing that, you know, I'm not going to, like, cross over and suddenly write about white people. There are plenty of people who do
you
that already.
You could include, like, a pasty white podcaster in one of your books.
I could do that. Yeah. I do have pasty white people in the books. You know, they're just, like, part of the landscape. But, you know, I'll have, like...
He was afraid of the sun.
My first book has a white male sidekick, you know? So it's, like...
That's what you should do, just to get back at Chandler. You could be like, there's a white guy smoking pot in his car instead of the Native American. Well, it's been so fun talking with you.
Yeah.
I appreciate you coming over.
Thank you for having me on. This is really cool.
Well, yeah, and congrats on the books. Best of luck with everything. I'm going to go look up your Yelp as soon as you leave. I hope you realize this. The koala hat, for those of you listening, go
it's
look
Steph
at
C.
Steph C.
on Yelp.
All right, Steph. Thank you.
Ed, thanks.
All right, there you go. That's it. That's Steph Cha. Her book is called Beware, Beware. It's available now from Minotaur. Please pick up a copy and read that copy. You can find Steph online. Her web address is stephcha.wordpress.com. Her Twitter handle is at StephYCha. And she's also on Yelp. She's a prolific Yelper, so follow her on Yelp. She'll tell you what to like. Thank you to Kill Rockstars, as always, for all the good music. Be sure to check out killrockstars.com. Don't forget to go get the app. This program has its own app. The app is free. It's available wherever apps are available. It's the best way to listen. You get the app on your device. The most recent 50 episodes are available free of charge. And then if you want to stream the full archives, if you want access to all 300 and something episodes, you just sign up for a premium account right there within the app. It's very cheap. It's very easy to do. And I would certainly appreciate it. If you want to send an email, the address is letters@otherppl.com. I love hearing from you guys, as I mentioned at the top of the show. Feel free to write to me and let me know what you think. I'm sorry for being too elliptical in the previous monologue, episode 318. It's tough stuff to talk about. Sensitive. I get concerned or a little anxious trying to talk about something that has legal ramifications when I don't know exactly what everything means or how all the facts stack up. What I can tell you is that men behaving badly, without question, in all three instances. And I think at least two of the three men would agree. I can't speak for Ed. I don't know. See, now I sound like it. Well, no, you're agreeing with Steven and... No, I'm not. I'm just saying they both have come out and said they feel like they recognize that they were not behaving well. It's very fraught. I almost just slid down. Do you see that? I almost got sucked into a dark hole. Oh, see, and that now I just said dark hole. What does that mean? I'm telling you, man. It's a minefield. Please remember that Tolstoy was abusive to his servants and that Pablo Neruda died of leukemia. That's it for now. I'm just going to stop talking. Thank you to Steph Cha for being a guest on this program. She was lovely. Go get her book. And thanks to you guys for listening, as always. I really appreciate it. I will be back on Sunday with another episode, another conversation, another writerly type human being. And hopefully in my monologue, I will be talking about something very positive.